Thank you for joining us this week. I have Brandi Posey on the podcast. Hello. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This is awesome. first of all, I apologize. I didn't know about your comedy earlier.
Oh, that's okay.
No, seriously, you should chastise me.
Son of a bitch.
I'm a bastard. but I saw the show. Do you organize the show at Pinup?
Yeah, it's going to be every 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. That was the very first one.
Okay.
I'm like the producer of the stand-up side, and then Julia Prescott is the producer of the gallery side, mm-hmm. and then we work with Natasha Estrada as part of the Pinup Girl Clothing. She like asked us to come and do the show there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And like I do, that's a new show. I've been producing comedy shows for like 6-7 years,
sure.
or something like that in L.A.
Yeah.
Like I have a podcast called Lady to Lady that's also a live show that we've done at UCB.
It's hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
I love that show.
Appreciate it. and then I have a show called Picture This that we do right now at the Tripany House, which used mm-hmm. to be the Steve Allen, and that's comedians paired up with animators,
mm-hmm.
and they live animate your jokes behind you during your set.
Holy shit. Are you kidding me?
Oh, no, it's a blast.
That's mind-blowing.
And we get people that, like, work on, like, all the Adult Swim shows, like Metalocalypse, and, like, all, like...
Holy crap.
The animators that we get are awesome. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's... We've had, like,
When's the next show?
the next one, it'll be the... Whatever the last Friday in May is.
Okay.
Yeah, 25th-ish, somewhere
right.
in there.
Sorry to interrupt.
Sorry to, like, plug up at the top.
No, are you kidding? It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that show, because it forces comedians outside of your jokes,
mm-hmm.
which, I like it because it makes your words not quite so, they aren't quite so, like, special to you.
Because right.
You're forced yeah. outside of your jokes. It's like, oh, no, this isn't, I have to get rid of my ego, because mm-hmm. I'm not going to be as dynamic as the giant penis being drawn behind me.
Right.
Which is what always happens.
Of course.
Because where do you heighten? After a certain point, the
right.
animators are just like, well, that's just what's going to happen.
That's mind-blowing,
yeah.
though.
Aw, thank you.
I just the idea of getting outside of, well, I hate to say outside of your comfort zone, but you know
yeah.
what I'm saying. But no, don't be precious about, like, mm-hmm. the syntax, even. Which
yes.
is so, like, we get nerdy about it.
Oh, exactly. And like, I mean, not to, like, we don't need to jump right into Billy Connolly right now, but, like, that's a big thing that I love about him, and that his words and his jokes are not precious to him. It's just,
right.
it's the experience,
yeah.
it's fun, and,
mm-hmm.
like, that's something that Picture This has, like, forced me to be like, you know what? The exact wording of this, while, yes, it's funny in, like, the optimal setting,
sure.
it's just, comedy's just goofing around.
Yeah.
It's goofing,
yeah.
it's having fun,
mm-hmm.
it's inviting people to, like, laugh with you at stuff,
yeah.
and, like, that's what Picture This kind of does. We just...
That's
goof
so
off
good.
With animators that, like, it's also cool to see your jokes like filtered through somebody else's
yeah.
Brain, because it's like, oh, well, when I talk about a Pegasus, I see it one way,
right?
And then to see somebody else what their Pegasus
mm-hmm.
is, you're like, oh,
you
oh,
can,
okay,
it's like slower improv, I imagine. You
yeah.
can bounce off that a little bit,
exactly.
It just takes a bit.
I definitely found, like, new tags and jokes doing that show,
really,
just because I'm like, oh, and then this is funny.
Yeah.
Like, I never would have saw it until I had physically, like, seen what the joke looks like that somebody else has said.
That's awesome.
Oh, thank you.
I'm glad you... Okay, so, yeah, let's get to it. You picked Billy Connolly,
mm-hmm.
specifically Big Ian, right?
Yeah.
The first thing I ever listened to was, like, a best of from, like, 78-ish.
That sounds about right. I mean, he's kind of like... Billy's great because he's more of, like, a Renaissance man, where
mm-hmm.
he is a comedian, but he started out... He was a folk musician first, and
right.
he made... you know, a name for himself as that, and then he was like, oh, no, I'm actually really funny, too. So
yeah.
it's him on stage with a guitar and a banjo,
mm-hmm.
and it's him telling, like, some jokes and some stories, and then he'll, like, do a song that reminds him of it, and kind of just entertaining the entire night. And
right.
it's fun because that album is also... Most of his albums he seems to record in, like, Scotland or overseas,
mm-hmm.
and there's just so much of that culture that I don't understand.
Sure,
that,
yeah.
Which
oh,
kind
it's
of
hard,
makes
yeah.
it more fun to be like,
yeah.
I don't know what that reference is.
But it sounds hilarious.
They loved it,
uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, he's talking about the difference between, like, in the one I listen
uh-huh.
to, this would be fun bouncing back and forth.
Yeah.
But, and actually in the one that I grew up listening to, which mm-hmm. was called The Pick of Billy Connolly, and had a lot of, some from this album, the
yeah.
74 one, it's a lot of, like, here's how Glasgow people talk. We all know how Glasgow people talk,
yeah.
you know? And it's like, it was hilarious to me at 12. I'm like, that's great. Like,
yeah.
for me, it was just like, I don't get it, but these people love this shit. And they're talking
oh, yeah.
about marital aids. I'm like, I don't know what that means, but that sounds really dirty, so.
But, I mean, I've seen him live 3 times.
Oh.
And he, God bless his soul, he comes to town, it seems like, every 3 years, right around my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like my birthday present for myself is I get 2 Billy Connolly
oh.
tickets, and I'm always just like, who is... who wants the other one.
Right,
let's
right,
do,
right.
Let's do this.
That's amazing.
This past year, it just happened last March, and I was seated two rows behind Sacha Baron Cohen and his wife Isla Fisher, and I got to watch them watch Billy Connolly, which was really awesome to see, because you're like, oh man, well you're like a comedy icon too, and then four rows in front of him was Eric Idle.
Oh,
so
fuck.
I didn't get to watch Eric Idle, but I like saw him sit down and I was like, dude, you guys are just sitting in the seats. Like, you're in this audience, too, and that's so cool to me. That, that's like, you could have pulled Hollywood and been backstage watching this.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, but, like, you wanted to be in the crowd. It was just, I don't listen to his albums that much, because him live is just, he's such a force.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's just such a physical life force that you just feel, like, he makes you feel more alive, just, like, listening to him. Because some of the biggest themes that he goes through in a lot of his work is, like, he likes to be an exotic person. He likes to live life and experience stuff. He hates beige people that just like aren't interested in anything outside of themselves and just say no to everything.
Yeah.
I've read his biography that his wife wrote a couple years ago, or she wrote it. I read it a couple years ago. She wrote it, I think, like in the late 90s or something.
Okay.
And it's just, he's lived an insane, amazing life that did not start out very well at all.
Mm-hmm.
And just to have made everything from absolutely nothing and to be so, like, just fun and cavalier and, like, one of the true raconteurs that's actually out there.
Because
I could listen to that guy talk about anything.
Yeah.
And he also, like, he has obviously written material, but no two sets are ever the same.
Uh-huh.
He goes out with like three or four words on a piece of paper, and then he does 2 hours, and like one story will take him 45 minutes, and you're like, how?
Holy crap! And he's 70. Not that that should make a difference, but he's 70.
He's 70, and he's still got it. It's
holy crap.
I know 30-year-olds that have less life than that guy.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And like the one that I just saw when I just saw him live. He's had like a rough couple of years with like cancer and Parkinson's.
Right.
Anybody knows that. And like he comes out and he just out of the gate was just like, hey, let's talk about this. I might shake at some point during the show. And then he like made fun of his hand
of
shaking.
Of course, of course.
And then he was like, well, we've acknowledged it. And then he just moved
amazing.
On.
Oh, that's perfect.
And I was like, you were just like, comedy at its best is inspiring.
Yeah.
When it is funny and makes you feel better. And like, it's just like, man, you've had like a great life that you created for yourself, but you've been handed, you know, a lot of shit along the way,
right?
And like, you have such a good self, like you have such a good sense of humor about all of it, and I love that guy.
Is music still as much a part of the show?
Not as much anymore. I don't know how much he can still play the
banjo.
That
was my question.
The last two times I've seen him, he hasn't played.
Okay.
The first time I saw him, he did play, but not as much. I think when he does the shows out here, because his audience is also, it's interesting because it's pockets from so many different places, because he has like the bluegrass fans, he has the comedy fans,
right?
He has like the people that are just Scottish that just love him because he's
100%,
Scottish,
yeah.
And then there's the like the people that love his movie career too.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's a fucking phenomenal actor too.
Oh, he's amazing.
I could do a whole episode on what's it called, Mrs. Brown. Have you seen that film?
I have not seen Mrs. Brown.
Amazing.
Yeah,
he plays Queen. Oh my God, I'm retarded. Queen Victoria's lover.
Ooh.
And it's a very staid, like, understated performance that you don't expect from loud-ass Billy Connolly.
Yeah.
And it's just phenomenal.
I'd believe it. I mean, his childhood was really fucked up. And I feel like that, people that have that, they have, like, there's a stillness about them that they, not that they run from the rest of the time,
right?
But they just choose not to access. And
sure.
I think when given a role like that, it's like, oh no, they have this whole well that they haven't even tapped into. It's like you watch like Jim Carrey in his serious work, and you're like, wow, the guy's got sadness.
Oh yeah,
that he's just and he's just dipped his toe into that.
Yeah,
I wish he would do more. I mean, this is not about Jim Carrey, but he is like the most important comedian in my life.
Really?
But he's just never put out an album, so we can't talk about it.
Right, no, that's true. Oh my God, that's really true. I hadn't thought about that. I was thinking about it earlier, though, is like, even listening just to his early stuff, he's impossible. Billy Connolly's impossible to pigeonhole as one type of comedian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He tells stories, but then he also tells dumb jokes.
Yeah.
Funny songs, sometimes some serious songs,
yeah.
or just plain old songs. It's it's almost difficult to label him a comedian, except for the fact that he's just naturally funny.
Exactly, you exactly. know? It's like, that guy never did, he definitely never did open mics. Cause
right.
He didn't have them in Glasgow in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
And he was already like a, you know, a relatively famous folk musician at that time, too. Right. So, I mean, he just, he's to me, like, he's a comedian, but he's more storyteller comedian.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, but he can also deliver a joke when he wants to. It just seems like he doesn't fit into a category that most other people fit into.
Right.
You know, because he is so many different things.
Now, as most of you probably realize, I do my act, or most of my act, in a Glasgow accent. Now, it's not because I like the Glasgow accent, really. It's because I've great difficulty doing any other kind of accent. This is true.
Because he even does, like, street jokes on stage.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, because I'm just like, man, like, if anybody else, if Patton Oswalt did street jokes...
Right, right.
People would be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, they have this expectation, but with Billy Connolly, he...
Yeah.
There's an expectation only that he'll be funny, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what it is. It's like, one of the things that I kind of picked up from him that I try to think of when I do my own stand-up is... he has this thing that, like, he hasn't coined this term, but I've coined it. It's the art of the casual alpha, where you were just casually in control like, running the party.
Yeah.
And like, hey, we're going to have a good time. Shut the fuck up. But I'm in charge and you're okay with it.
Yeah.
And like, that's like this, there's this air about him that's just like, hey man, you can talk if you want. I'm going to shut you down. Oh, so you're not going to.
He's so good at it too.
Oh, I mean, that guy, his brain goes a mile a minute. It's, it's nuts to watch him deal with hecklers.
Yeah.
He just will go after them for 20 minutes.
So he doesn't mind, like, not getting past it immediately. As long as they shut the fuck up.
Yeah, as long as they shut up. And they usually shut up quickly. He doesn't like to be heckled. But like, if somebody goes after, if somebody says, even just yells something at him, like, Boondock Saints, he will just... 20 minutes of the night is dedicated to what a piece of shit you are.
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
Holy crap. Because, now that you say that, like, again, the first stand-up album I ever heard was that mixtape of his. Well, not a mixtape, but a best of.
Yeah.
And he shuts down a heckler very quickly. He just says, do I come down where you work and tell you how to sweep up? No. And then everybody goes nuts and done and done stuff. I was like, oh my God, this is the funniest thing I've ever heard. Like, to me, the 12-year-old kid, oh my God, that's true. It's the first time I ever heard anybody get shut down like that in a live show. And he's one of those people I don't think who could I don't know, it's some people's stand-up albums are very very polished, very borderline pretentious, potentially, you know what I mean?
Oh, no, definitely.
Like, even like, especially if you, I'm thinking maybe of TV specials like Raw and stuff, which I love Raw, but like, it's like, look at me. But Billy Connolly isn't that guy.
No.
He couldn't be that guy.
No, he couldn't be that guy. I don't think he'd want to be that guy. Mm-mm. That's too much work on one specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like that he always has always felt to me like he's the kind of guy that, like, he realized very young that life is short. Here are a couple of things that I love to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that means I'm going to do all of them well, but I'm not going to obsess over one of them.
Right.
And I'm going to just have fun doing these four or five things. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's fine.
Yeah.
And like, he really like makes you think about the ego of comedy and how it's just, it gets in the way of like doing the actual work and like just be fun.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
And that is, I won't say that's missing, but definitely in the 90s when perfecting irony became an art.
Yeah.
We lost a lot of the fun.
Yeah. Well, know? I mean, I don't know if I've ever talked about this on a podcast or not before, but like I was born in 84, so the 90s were my comedy years, and I'm a stand-up now, but the only reason I'm really a stand-up now is because, like, when I first moved to LA, like, 7 years ago, I would go to UCB, and I was like, oh, stand-up is funny again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I knew it was funny in the 70s and the early 80s, and then I would watch stuff on Comedy Central in the 90s, and I was like, this is awful. I wouldn't want those to be my peers.
Yeah.
So why would I even... pursue this.
Exactly.
So I grew up with, like, you know, SNL, Mad TV, more like the ensemble cast were really important to me, which I think is interesting because you definitely see with people who are coming up in comedy now a more collaborative sense, and I think that has to do a lot with the 90s just sucking shit in stand-up.
It's true. No, it's so absolutely true.
Yeah, so it's actually kind of nice that happened.
Yeah.
You know, it's because we all have real friends now.
Right. I've talked about it on this podcast before. Like, I almost forgot stand-up was a thing.
Yeah.
Until I moved here. And even until I started listening to podcasts, I was like, oh my God, people are still making a living at it. I'm ignoring this whole thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So do you remember what kind of a show you saw the first time when you got here, where you're just like, oh, or who you might have seen?
Paul Tompkins is a huge, huge guy for me.
Of course.
I mean, because, you know, Imperfect, that album. Uh-huh. I've listened to tracks on that album like they are songs.
Yeah.
Because it's so good. And the opposite of Billy in the sense that it is so written.
Mm-hmm.
But he also has, like, in that album, the fun on stage.
Yeah.
I don't like if you laugh too much at yourself.
Of course.
But I like it when you still get a rise out of yourself on stage. Because there's just something fun about, like, there's a difference between, like, look how clever I am.
Right.
And just, like, this is so stupid.
Yeah.
And, like, that definitely came across for me. I mean, I used to go to, like, the Benson Interruptions all the time and stuff. And, I mean, just seeing, like, the camaraderie among those guys was just like, oh, you guys are talking about stuff that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I would actually, like, have a drink with you at a bar or something. I would actually like to have a conversation with you as opposed to, like, backwards baseball caps, like, hey, he's fucking bitches.
Yeah, right.
Which is just, like, what I thought stand-up had become.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that does still exist out there. But, I mean, you know, when you find this whole other world, you're like, oh no, these people are great.
Right.
There's a lot of, like, interesting, really smart, weirdly broken people that are, like, similar to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be awesome.
Like, The Interruption's actually a good example of a type of show that seems like it could be, it appears competitive, but it's so collaborative.
Yeah.
Where these guys could be backstage looking at, you know, being like, oh, he's doing really well. Fuck that
guy. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And whereas opposed to, you know, we're fucking with each other on stage. We can play along.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, for you, for the most part, are you, when you do stand-up, are you feeling like backstage, is it different than what you expected it to be originally? Or maybe has it changed since you started doing it?
It's changed, like, a little bit. I mean, I just have my 6-year comedy anniversary. So,
that's awesome.
Thank you. Like, when I first started open mics and stuff, we definitely... It's cool because I've been told by a lot of people who are a couple years older than like, my quote-unquote class of comedians.
Mm-hmm.
When there's, like, 5 or 6 of us that when we all started, we kind of came in with a very similar mentality of, like, we grew up listening to punk rock music, and we were like, DIY is very important to us.
Sure.
And, like, we were very alt, even though, like, we didn't really understand what that term meant at the time. Mm-hmm. We just knew that, like, if the improv doesn't put me up, I'm just going to go run a bunch of my own shows.
Sure. Yep.
And a bunch of us just kind of, we liked each other a lot, and we, like, genuinely as friends, and, like, would hang out outside of open mics, which everyone else was like, it's weird that you guys are buddies, and you, like, support each other's shows, and you don't view each other as competition all the time. And it's like, well, the internet's also there, and it makes it, there are so many ways to make a decent living, you know, at comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all got that, like, we're just going to suck for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it is,
yep.
You know, and the long haul of that is just kind of fun and takes a little bit of the edge off until people start getting stuff.
Definitely.
And then we'll see how our friendships hold up.
Right. Oh, do you want some water, by the way?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Sorry,
yeah.
I can.
That's okay.
Right. So actually the next thing I was going to bring up was going to be YouTube after you mentioned that, because it's something that people sort of forget when they think about how collaborative YouTube is.
Mm-hmm.
That there was kind of a team on the ground, as it were, that was still taking care of that in real life, because, you know, it's one of those things that people do assume that anybody who gets famous on YouTube is only famous because of YouTube, that they didn't try beforehand, that they just put a video up, that, you know, there's an assumption that if you're young, if you're on YouTube, if you're popular, maybe you didn't try that hard.
Yeah.
But clearly, I mean, I'm sure everybody in your group has a YouTube channel. Everybody in your group is trying to do that shit online as well.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
But, you know, people should not forget, I think, that there are people still busting their asses to put their stuff together in real life.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's... The internet's like a double-edged sword, because I think it makes it, you know, it's hard to put all of your work into a live show and then have 40 people see it.
Yep.
When you could just put it online and hopefully millions do.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, I mean, like with Lady to Lady, we do a live talk show. And for the first 2 years that we were together, we did it every month, and it just killed us.
Yeah.
And now we can't. When we started the podcast, we're like, we only started the podcast really because we're like, this will be easier, and we'll get to work on our rapport together.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized, oh man, we're like, we're reaching a lot more people this way,
mm-hmm.
and this is great.
Yeah.
But you know, we still do the live show every couple of months now, but it's more like a special thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to just that being the goal of. Yeah. You know, the show, what we do together now.
I can see that.
Yeah.
So how long have you been doing the podcast then?
We have, what, like 74 or 5 episodes?
Okay.
So about we've been in the podcast a little bit over 2 years, maybe.
Okay.
Close to that.
Right.
No, less than that. That's not how many weeks there are in anything. but like maybe a year and a half somewhere around.
All right. So you're making me look bad. Everybody listens to this podcast is like, you haven't reached 100 yet. And how long have you been around? That's okay. That's fine. That's fine.
There was a young Glasgow chap. And he was trying to phone his girlfriend, and he was in a great deal of trouble. He's going, hey, come on, hello! I'm saying hello, oh! Hey, hey! So he's in this terrible trouble. So he dialed the operator. She says, hello? He says, hello, daddy operator now! Oh. And she says, yes? He says, well, wait a minute, you know what I mean? I'm trying to phone that daft bird of mine, know what I mean? Putting money in and pressing all these daft buttons, nah, no. I'm losing the play jar to get out here, know what I mean? I'm going to go right ahead. See, youth people, something should be done about youth people. Hanging's too good for youth people. No kidding. It's a good kick in the arse you need, know what I mean? Pressing all these buttons like right, I'm going to go right, I'm losing the play jar to get out here, know what I mean? She says, now just take it easy, sir. Take it easy. Now look, is there money in the box? He says, no, I'm in here myself.
Do you remember the first time you heard Billy Connolly at all or knew who Billy Connolly was and then maybe discovered he was a comedian? I don't know if that was
I think I remember trying to think of like when the first time I saw, it's funny because when I saw Boondock Saints I was like, this guy is obviously somebody,
mm-hmm.
and then I looked him up and that's kind of think when I found like clips of him or the
old
albums and was like, oh, it's great. And I then I realized I had seen him do like talk shows and stuff a couple of times, and that's where I was like, oh, this guy seems like fun,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't until like the first year that I moved out to LA about 70 years ago that I was I don't even know how I got an email that was like, Billy Connolly, one night only in Los Angeles. And I was like, I want to see that guy.
Holy shit.
He seems like fun. So yeah. I like went to go see him live and was like, oh, he's amazing.
That's
like,
awesome.
He was next level stand-up. Mm-hmm. I mean, UCB was amazing because you'd see those guys.
Of course.
And then you'd see like Billy Connolly in like a giant 700-seat theater. And you're mm-hmm. like, ooh. And I mean, not to say that UCB guys can't do a 700-seat theater,
sure.
but it was just like to see these huge differences in like what people could do. And I was like, and you were having this much fun.
Yeah.
And you made so much money tonight and that doesn't even matter to you.
Right.
Because you're still having this much fun on stage.
Yeah.
You know, and like that's just, I don't know.
And a guy like that who's not, quote unquote, trained in comedy. He's not a guy who moved. He's not one of many, as they have now, that just moved to L.A. to do comedy. To learn comedy. Take classes. Pay to take classes.
Exactly.
He's a guy who, I won't say lucked into it, but, you know, not unlike the Smothers Brothers, who do briefly start out as an actual folk group and then made it funny.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. I think it just, I mean, it's so funny because you always hear that comedians want to be rock stars and rock stars want to be comedians, and be like, I only managed to pull off both, which is, like, doesn't happen very often.
Right.
I think he's maybe, like, maybe the only one that I can think of off the top of my head that is really great at both of them.
Yeah.
Isn't
just doing goofy songs, but is legitimately talented at both.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, on like the 2001 Big Yin record, he's like noodling around a little bit, tells a couple of stories, and then the last four tracks are just songs, and there's one that he just opens up and is just shredding on the banjo, and you're like, oh yeah, like you're really good at that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I mean, it's so funny that the banjo is like an instrument that so many comedians have associated with them. Like, I mean, Steve Martin, obviously most famously, right. But like, I mean, Ed Helms is also a really great banjo player.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, it's so funny that that's like an instrument that seems to pop back up again and again in comedy.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a thing that keeps, because so many comedians, maybe I'm speaking from too much personal experience, like have massive OCD.
Yeah.
And something like a banjo keeps your mind occupied so much.
Yeah.
You know, and you can still be, because it's kind of it's a funny sounding instrument.
Yeah.
But when you somehow can like play blisteringly fast on this goofy, it suddenly is no longer goofy.
Yeah.
It's kind of awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why that is.
Yeah.
But it's kind of mind blowing.
No, totally. And, you know, which is like a good metaphor for comedy when, you know, when a joke is good, it's really funny, but you're also like, oh, that made me think. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. I mean, I grew up as a musician. Like, I played the French horn from the time I was in fourth grade until, you know, I still will pull it out every couple of months. And be like, can I still do this a little bit? Okay, good. Like, I will be homeless with that instrument. I'll never sell it.
Right.
Music was my first love.
That's awesome.
You know, I loved it so much. But I loved it so much I didn't want to make a career out of it. So I was like, this is not the thing that I'm going to haggle with people on. This is not the thing that I'm going to, like, I want this to still be a hobby. That's fun for me.
Right.
You know, and then comedy, I was like, oh, well, I'll sell out with that. That's
what did it take for you to find it in yourself to commit to comedy? Did you need something to push you, or were you just like, no, this is natural, this is absolutely what I have to do?
I knew, I had like a moment when I was in second grade. I saw Ace Ventura 2.
Uh-huh.
This is why Jim Carrey will come back up.
Uh-huh.
Ace Ventura 2, in the theaters. I was in second grade, so I was young. For those listening, the people who are a little bit older than me are always just like, are you kidding me right now? And I'm like, no, when you're in second grade, Jim Carrey was flawless in the 90s.
Sure.
He had a perfect decade.
Yes.
He's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I mean, when you were a kid that age, it was amazing. And, like, that, the scene where he, like, falls out of the rhino's ass, that whole scene was, like, a wake-up moment for me. And I was like, I don't want to do that specifically.
Right, right, right.
But, like, I want to be in the world that made this happen, because this is, like, I've never laughed at anything so hard in my life.
Yeah.
And I just want to do this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, from that moment on, it was, like, I wasn't, like, a class clown, but I was, like, a, you know, I was funny with my friends, and we were always, like, doing weird skits and videos and stuff, but, like, you know, kind of in the corner.
Of course.
And then I went to film school to, like, to write and make funny shorts and stuff, and would, like, constantly get into the fights with my over-serious film professors. And, I mean, just, man, about... I went to Drexel in Philadelphia, and, I mean, it was great because it was, like, a hands-on college, but it was also, like, I had professors that would say things like, this guy, Professor Hooper, Jerry Hooper, he's this white dude with a black beard, but he, like, hated the fact that he was white so much. He was like, damn, this Anglo-Saxon name. If you had, like, anything exotic about your name at all, he would be like, what? Tell me about your history. And he used to shoot documentaries and stuff, and he was like, I once, what did he say in class one time? He was like, I once drank vodka on the Himalayas with the last remaining members of Stalin's communist Russia. Like, he just lived for those kind
of
stories.
Of course.
Hated comedy.
Oh, my God.
Hated comedy.
Of course he did.
And I'd bring in sketch ideas, because I didn't want to do short films. I wanted to make sketches.
Yep. Yeah.
And I was like, short films are just sketches that don't make you cry. What do you
Right. Right?
Right? That's all it is?
Mm-hmm.
What's the matter? And I would bring in ideas, and I remember specifically bringing in this idea for, I wanted to do like a faux documentary about interviewing nice guys before and after a race, and like about them actually finishing last physically of a race. And he was like, so why are you lonely? What is, like, when was your last relationship? And I was like, it's a clever, funny thing. Why is it, why am I,
fuck.
And we're constantly arguing with, had to fight for everything, but it made me justify, like, why I thought things were funny early on, which was great. And so I like went to school for writing, and then I, like, you know, and film production, and then I moved out to LA, and I wanted to be a comedy writer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started going to stand-up classes or stand-up shows and stuff, and I'd be like, I think I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try it and see what happens. And right before I turned 24, I said, "Oh, fuck it!" And I got like a 3-week stand-up workshop at the Improv Olympic West. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And where I met Vanessa Ramos. Me and her started comedy at the same time. Mm-hmm. We're buddies from that. And we bonded over how much we hated our teacher. And once again had to justify everything that we thought was funny in
right.
the world.
Right.
Which was super fun to be like, ah, God, why are you telling me to do this?
Isn't this obvious?
Yeah. I remember being told, oh, you're like Janine Garofalo. You're one of those alt comics. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. That's a bad thing.
Right.
Because I know her name, but I'd never heard yours before. So.
Oh, it's so hard.
Yeah, I know.
You're just flashing me back to film school, though. That's the worst. I honestly, like, if I'd have realized in film school that all I wanted to do was actually do comedy in some way,
yeah,
I probably would have left film school, to be honest, you know?
No, definitely. I mean, I made some really good friends there, and it, like... It taught me how to run a set, and mm-hmm. like that's a good skill to
definitely.
Have, because there's nothing that takes the funny out of a short film or a sketch more than like a set that is not well run.
Yep.
Like
yep.
don't make me be on set for 12 hours if it's only 30-second thing.
Seriously.
Let's do it quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plan stuff out, because that way you can actually improvise and have fun with it.
Yes.
As opposed to like, we gotta get this take, we gotta do it, get the punchline, be funny. No. But yeah, I don't know. I just started stand up after that when I got out here, and saw Billy shortly after that, and was like, "Yep, nope, that's." My grandmother was also like she was a storyteller.
Uh-huh.
Like she was the kind of person that would you'd be in line in the grocery store, and she'd make friends with everybody around her.
Mm-hmm.
And like Billy reminded me of her in a lot of ways, because
yeah.
it was like, oh man, like I bet you, if I just ran into that dude on the street, he'd be a delight.
Yes,
he'd be just a delight to just. We sell that guy's shoes, you know, anything,
yeah.
anything. Like, I'm going to pump that guy's gas,
mm-hmm.
you know, because he's going to say something delightful. And I just, you know, you want to be, it's like people like that you just kind of like, you're like, you know what, you're put here to make everyone's days a little bit better.
Right.
And that's what comedy really should end up kind of being about.
Definitely.
You know, at some degree, it's like, oh no, you know, we gave somebody a reprieve from an otherwise, you know, boring and sad march to death.
And he's taking his own aging in stride, it sounds like.
Oh,
it's just
completely.
So mind-blowing to me.
Completely.
I couldn't do that. Most comedians can't do that shit.
No.
We're depressed assholes in a lot
yeah.
of ways. Not everybody. I'm not judging. I'm
no,
not saying
no.
you are.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I'm depressed, but like I'm good at like knowing my place in the depression
yes.
food chain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
makes sense. It's
mm-hmm.
like, there's you know, there's stuff that makes me sad, but it's also, I also don't think that it's, I don't know, I've been in therapy forever because I think it's really important
yeah.
to work on your brain.
Absolutely.
And you only get to do this once.
Mm-hmm.
You might as well understand everything about why your brain works the way it does.
Yes.
So it's like, I'm depressed, but I also, like, I understand it enough to be like, oh, this is, I know how to get out of this if I need to.
Right.
You know, I have a toolbox that,
mm-hmm.
I can work with.
So the guy next to you has to pinch the buckle for the guy next to him. Whoop. Click. And he goes to sleep as well. The guy at the end's left with one bit of seatbelt. No buckle. Has to tie it around his leg. Kid on, he's sleeping and off. And then, woof, off you go. And you're up there. Reading the safety instructions. They give you a safety belt and a cushion. What's the cushion for? You're supposed to tuck it under your body and bend over it with your wee silly belt on. Now, supposing you're heading for a mountain at 500 miles an hour. Oh! With your safety belt and your cushion in your hand. What'd you do with your cushion? Do you all throw it at the one time and you say, go away, nasty mountain! That's what you do.
And knowing that perspective, actually, of being depressed helps you come up with so much material, I'd imagine.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, well, look at how... Isn't it really funny when I can look at it through that lens? But it's good that I can look back
exactly.
from here and
yeah.
not constantly, because in no way is it going to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because then that becomes sort of, you're living in the depression. And then
exactly.
And you hear that. I mean, I've seen comedians do that.
Oh, yeah.
Who are clearly working shit out on stage
yeah.
and not,
mm-hmm.
yeah, not
well,
polishing
it gets,
it.
Sometimes, I mean, I think it's really important with comedy to remember that funny over everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, even... every comedian is trying to be funny about everything. I mean, that should be your goal. It shouldn't be, don't bum the audience out with your stuff. I mean, you can talk about serious things,
sure,
obviously, but like, you need to find a way for everyone to laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't. You know, even Bill Hicks wanted to be funny when he was really going after some shit. You know, I mean,
as my next thought was Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
Walked the line.
Yeah, he walked the line, but like, funny mattered more. Yes. I think. I mean, obviously that guy's gonna like go off every once in a while, but like, he wants it to be funny.
Yeah,
he doesn't want to just preach at you.
No.
I mean, even Sam Kinison didn't want to just preach at you, and he was literally a preacher.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean,
it's true.
Yeah, it's like, funny over everything is what matters with that stuff. And I mean, Billy, the way he, like, talks about, yeah, I mean, he's talking about Parkinson's and cancer, and, like, that guy's 70, like, he isn't, I mean, I hope he lives forever.
Yes.
And knowing the life force that he brings on stage, he very well might.
Yep.
I wouldn't be surprised. But it's like, I mean, he's seen some grim stuff.
I bet.
I mean, he was He was like molested by his dad growing up.
Jesus Christ.
He like grew up dirt poor. It was like him and his sister in a room. I think his mom ran out on them. He only met his real mom once.
My God.
Yeah, he only met his real mom once because she was young when they got married,
yeah.
And like the dad became an alcoholic, and she was like, peace, and she just left.
Fuck.
So he's got like half brothers and sisters. And
yeah.
He's like met once or twice, and he's like, okay, well, I don't know you.
Yeah.
And I mean, just grim stuff. He was like, he went to a Catholic school and he was beat to hell all the time by like nuns and everything. And like, to have like lived through all of that, figured it out. I mean, his dad never apologized for what he did.
Oof.
And like, they still had a relationship because he's like, what am I going to do? Not have a relationship with my father.
Right.
But like, they could never get through it because his dad, I forget what war his dad fought in, but it was like, when he came back from war, is like, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh.
Wow.
Wow, okay. I don't know what that brought out in you.
Jesus Christ.
But it's like, I mean, like, grim stuff, and he still makes it funny when he talks about it on stage.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, man, that could be so unfunny and awful.
Yeah.
And, but I mean, you like have to strike a balance between, the audience can't be like, I hope they're okay. You know,
right.
you need them to know that you're okay.
Mm.
You know, to be like, hey, nah, I got it. We've all got stuff, you know? And you just, yeah. That's another lesson that Billy reminds me of constantly, where it's just like, oh, man, like, you've been through way worse than I've ever been through.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, to still, like, be as cavalier as you are, talking about that, talking about everything that you talk about on stage, to be that fun is just... awesome.
It's funny too, actually, if you listen to the one that I was listening to, again, so much of it is Scottish humor. It's about being Scottish. Some of that stuff is my favorite stuff, but it's very much he sucks people in by just making you feel welcome and making you feel, it's a lot like what Bill Cosby does, but it's maybe just a little more regional and a lot more foul on occasion.
Definitely. It's nasty. I love it.
Do you have a favorite bit of his from this album?
Because
again, I know there's stories, so it's hard to say a bit, but
yeah, it's hard to I even like re-listened to it today.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny because so much of his stuff is just really not even like, there aren't like specific punchlines that stand out.
Yeah,
I mean, it's so silly. He was telling a story about how he was talking to like a nurse or something backstage at a show, and she was so boring. He was just like, you're a nurse, tell me about something fucked up you've seen. Basically just like, tell me something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then she told him about this story of this guy that they had brought into the ER that had just passed away, that like he was so beat up he looked like he had fallen out of an airplane. And then it just goes on to this, Billy just is like, he just went on this 30-minute rant about airplanes. And, like, you know, how you have to be drunk to be on them, which is hilarious because he's a sober person.
Uh-huh.
And he just was talking about how just awful, how, like, the worst thing is if you have to take a shit on an airplane and you can't figure out how to flush the toilet because you can't leave, because if anybody is waiting, they will know that it is yours, whether or not it is yours. And he's so goofy. And he was like, I think that's how this guy got sucked out of the plane. And he brings it back to this guy that you'd forgotten about because it's been 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, that's where this, that's how you got here? You've been talking about, like, shit's flying into the ocean out of airplanes and then fish eating them and then you eating the fish and then that's what the circle of life actually is. And then we're going to get back to this guy that you found out about because this nurse was a horrible bore backstage at a show. And it's a 20-minute journey and you're like, what? I can't. You've covered so much. Mm-hmm, I don't even know what my favorite part is.
Seems like telling a good story seems to be the most important thing to him on the planet. Yeah. Then, if he's going to tell you a story about this person who's a fan of mine was nice enough to talk to me, but God, was she fucking boring.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Exactly. It's like, I mean, that guy's dinner parties have got to be legendary, I would assume.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... Yeah, he's I love that. I love, like, the effortless weaving of a tale and then, like, being surprised by where it goes and ends up. You know, that's something that, like, in my own stand-up, I try to, like, replicate to some degree, where, like, I usually try to start with, like, a grounded premise and we'll see where I can kind of take it to. Mm-hmm. It's, like, usually my, like, that tends to be my MO for most of my jokes.
Right.
And, I mean, he takes it to such an extreme with, you know, the crazy 20-minute stories that you're just like, what?
Yeah.
And it's... It's so funny along the way, and there aren't obvious punchlines, but just the way he tells the story is just like, man, you're magnetic.
Yeah.
And there's no way to learn that. You're born with that. You just have that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there have you found a way to make stream of consciousness funny to you, like, enough? Do you get comfortable with that, or are you very...
I mean, I'm...
Point by point.
If I have a longer set, yeah. Mm-hmm. I love riffing in my jokes, which is why I picture this as such a fun show for me to do, because I can kind of just let it go.
Yeah.
The problem with... I started in Los Angeles, so LA is my home city, and I love it, and I'm very proud of the comedy scene we have here.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the downsides is that, you know, you're doing showcase sets all the time.
Right.
You know, I mean, open mics, you're 3 minutes or 5 minutes. You know, there really isn't room to...
Yeah.
...to riff and, like, let yourself... Your brain kind of go somewhere there. Mm-hmm. And, I mean... You're booked on shows, maybe you're getting 8 or 10. And I mean, if you, it depends on the level of the show. It's like not a high pressure show. You can kind of mess around a little bit with like one bit. But if it is, you want to bring your polished stuff. Because LA's comedy scene is so big that you don't know the next time those people are going to see you. So you've got to kind of knock it out of the park every time. So you can't kind of play around.
Right.
For like a year and a half, I ran a show in Eagle Rock. Kind of just to play with that, actually. It was called The 4 and 20, and it was at the All-Star Lanes Bowling Alley, which is a bowling alley, Chinese restaurant, dive bar. And it was four comics doing 20 minutes each, and it was just us, and then, like, two transients that would come every week and watch.
Yeah.
Because Eagle Rock, I don't know if this is not, this was, I found this out, Eagle Rock is where all the prisons around here drop their inmates off, because it's the LA city limits.
Holy shit. That I didn't know.
Yeah, and once I found that out, it made all the sense in the world.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh, that explains Eagle Rock.
It really does.
Completely. Holy, I had no shit. Idea.
How do you do 20 minutes without an audience, though, or a minimal audience? How are you motivated?
I mean, my thing was, it was just, it's the only way that I was going to get 20 minutes of stage time.
Okay.
So some weeks I would come in with, like, I'm going to just hammer through 20 minutes of what these jokes are.
Mm-hmm.
And the couple guys that would come out, that were always, they would come every week.
Oh, okay.
Because they had nothing else.
Okay.
They literally slept on the steps of the church next door.
Yeah.
So they'd be like, oh, these are people that are going to treat us like humans.
Uh-huh.
Let's go watch their show. And they were probably two of my favorite audience members.
Uh-huh.
They're amazing. This guy named Arturo, who is at like 5 foot nothing, little Spanish guy, bald, who would just wear like old Budweiser t-shirts and then sneak in whatever beer cans they sold in the bowling alley.
Uh-huh.
And Arturo, I got him up on stage a couple of times, and he would tell these crazy stories about just one time he was dating a homeless woman that had a nub for a leg.
Uh-huh.
And he told a very filthy story about making love to the nub.
Oh my God.
And I was like, this is why the 4 and 20 existed for a year and a half, so I could conjure this into being.
Yep.
Because I'll never unhear this in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would, like, he would also tell me how, like, he would go to the karaoke at the bowling alley on the weekends, and once he got picked up by 2 60-year-old women who said they were going to just take him through the Jack in the Box drive-thru, and they ended up just taking him home and forcing him into a three-way with them.
Oh, my...
And he was like, hey, I'm homeless. You got to take what you can get. And I was like, Art, I love you. Everything about you is my favorite.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
You have to wonder if one of those stories that you're a part of at some point, like 30 years down the line, and that, you know, the greatest comedian of all time, Arturo. Yeah. You know, like, you just have to wonder if that's going to come in. That's phenomenal.
Oh, you hope so.
Wow.
Yeah, and, like, they would come out, and, like, they would heckle a little bit, but it was, like, the good-natured kind, mm-hmm. and it's like, oh, I'm sorry, the homeless guys don't know how to be a proper audience member.
Right, right.
But it was also, I mean, it was good, and it's one of those other things that I think it's kind of nice, because it knocks your ego down a peg or two.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wow, I couldn't draw more than a crowd of, like, two homeless guys.
Uh-huh.
All right, yeah, they can say whatever they want. That's fine.
Yeah.
How much better than them am I?
Right.
Really, when it comes 100%, down to it.
100%.
You know, so, I mean, it really, sometimes I would just come in with, like, hey, this thing happened this week, and then we kind of, like, go back and forth, and I'd, like, goof around, and, like, mm-hmm. you know, would find weird riffs in there. Like, I would like, find things online and be like, let me read this, and then I'll just go off of it. Like, mm-hmm. I remember I have, like, a bit about, Juggalo poetry that I found, and I found this message board full of Juggalo poetry.
Oh my god!
And I have this pro-life Juggalo poetry that was a part of it.
Oh shit!
And it's like my favorite. It's the end of the internet, so it's my favorite thing in the world.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I like went on this crazy rant at the 420 about how, like, it's political and about how. It's crazy that Juggalos have politics. I'd never thought about that.
Yeah.
And how we might actually elect a Juggalo president someday. And, like, how we probably won't elect a Juggalo, but we definitely elect the child of a Juggalo president. Because, uh-huh. like, the only way to rebel against your parents is to be the opposite of your parents.
Yes.
And the opposite of a Juggalo is the president.
Yep, yep.
And, like, I wouldn't have just gone on this weird Juggalo rant if I didn't have a show that I could just throw 20 minutes into every week.
Yeah.
And it was, like, so low pressure.
Mm-hmm.
The people, I mean, I would book, you know, I booked a lot of people that would just come out and they'd be like, huh, so this is what 20 feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do 20 in that environment,
mm-hmm.
then you could, if you have a crowd of any kind,
yeah.
you can do 20 and it doesn't feel like anything.
Yeah.
I think it's important. LA's comedy scene makes you, to some degree, train with weights on,
mm-hmm.
because you don't like, audiences out here can be good, but they can also be very apathetic.
Sure.
If you have an audience, period.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you go do shows outside of LA, you're like, oh, man, I just took that 5 pounds off the bat, and I'm knocking home runs. This
right.
is awesome.
Right. I mean, that's impressive, though, to do it, like, a lot of times if you're... crowd is mostly comedians. I mean, sometimes do you find them more favorable or less favorable, or do you find them, like, afraid to say anything or laugh?
Oh, to have, like, a crowd of comedians?
Yeah, if it's if you know there's a lot of comedians in the crowd. I mean,
I try not to play to comedians. I try not to make that joke that my thing. Like,
yeah.
Oh, if a couple of good friends are in the audience, I'll kind of, like, catch their eye at one point or another.
Sure.
But usually only if something horrible is happening on mm-hmm. stage, mm-hmm. where it's like, I'm not the only one alone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like having a couple comics in the crowd, because there is something with a bad show, too. There's something about, like, if a show is awful, as long as you have a war buddy,
mm-hmm.
it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, because you can both say, oh, man, well, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Tess Barker, one of the girls in Lady Lady, mm-hmm. she did a show up in Bakersfield one time with a couple comics that she didn't know, and... They were driving up. They were, like, half an hour away, and they got a phone call that was like, oh, by the way, the first show tonight, because they're doing the whole weekend, the first mm-hmm. show tonight, the majority of the audience is a school bus full of mentally challenged people.
Oh, Jesus.
So you won't be doing stand-up. We're just going to have you guys do improv.
Okay.
All right. And she was like, I'm still really good friends with those two dudes.
Yeah.
Because... we had to do that together.
Yeah.
You know, like, you had to go through that together. And it's like, once you, it's like people that, I mean, Jesus, like, people that lived through Nam have been through less than doing an hour and a half in front of a room full of mentally challenged people, which, I mean, mm-hmm. not that that's a bad audience.
No, I know what you're saying.
But, like, you're not an improv troupe.
Mm-hmm.
Improv is not stand-up.
No.
Improv is not stand-up, is not sketch. These are three very specific, different ways to do comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You can do all three.
Yes.
But, like, no.
Uh-huh.
You know, book a stand-up and say, oh, yeah, you're funny, you can do this. Mm-hmm. So they ended up just making faces and weird noises for, like, an hour and a half. And they're like, yeah, well, we killed.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, it's nice to have in a bad show situation, it's nice to have a couple comics that you can at least be like, oh, we lived through that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's good that we've made all the life choices that have brought us
right.
to this moment.
Yeah, 100%. Comedy is not in and that's one of the funny things too. So a lot of people, at least like myself, want to do comedy. That's a very generic thing to say you want to do.
Yeah,
it's not I applaud anybody who can say I want to do stand up for the most part. Because, hello, because it's easy to be a stand up and then it's understandable. Hey, you've also got a podcast.
Yeah,
you know. But, a lot of people just want to do comedy, and they don't know what they want to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it does take some time of just, like, dipping your toes a little bit.
For sure.
To be like, I mean, I took improv classes, hated it, hated it. I'm way too much of a control freak.
Yep.
I don't mind sharing a stage, but, like, I like to be able to weave the narrative a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I also am a writer first, so to not be able to, like, work on a line to over and over again to be like, oh, I just did that and it's done and it's gone forever. Like,
yeah.
That makes me feel crazy.
Sure.
I just didn't enjoy improv as much as, you know, people that are really good at improv, and that's great because, you know, they're better at that. I'm probably a better stand-up than they are. That's fine.
Right.
And I mean, I've done sketch stuff too, but I mean, it's like, I like sketch, but like stand-up is my baby because I can just, it's just me and a mic on a stage, and I can do that, and it doesn't, that's all I need.
Yeah. Did you ever make friends over comedy as a kid? I mean, did you sit and listen to albums or watch TV shows or anything like that and make friends over that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In middle school, especially, I remember there was like five or six girls that we were so obsessed with Seinfeld and Saturday Night Live that when we came in on Monday, we literally had notes from Saturday Night Live from the weekend, and we would be like, these were our favorite sketches. We would, like, write out sketches. Like, I specifically remember there is this, Steve Buscemi hosted SNL, and there was a sketch that he did where he was the Mad Hatter, and it was like, everybody was, like, being like, I'm so mad. I wear my socks on my hands and my gloves on my feet. And then he would just say, like, I'm so mad I make race cars out of my poop and light them on fire. And he was actually crazy. And then the sketch ends with him being like, I poisoned their tea. They're all dead. They don't even know it. And he gets pulled out. And it was just this so fucked up and weird. And I loved it so much that I remember transcribing it. I, like, videotaped it. That's I had it on VHS. Awesome. And, like, wrote the entire sketch out just to, like, see what this is, what a sketch looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we would, SNL Mondays, and then Fridays were Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, like, I mean, we made memes before memes were a thing based on Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember them being, like, there'd be, like, whatever the catchphrase was for the episode.
Yeah.
We would, like, write it on a piece of paper and, like, draw things with it and just would, like, hand it back and forth to each other in classes.
That's
and stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I mean, when Seinfeld went off the air, the day after it did that Friday, we all wore all black and then with the name of our favorite character on our shirts.
Awesome.
Yeah. George, personally.
That's fucking great.
Yeah, so I mean, I like that, and it was so funny because, like, there were a couple of guys in our group, but it was mostly, like, five or six girls, and we're all, like, really obsessed with those shows.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always funny when people are like, oh, yeah, all guys are comedy nerds. I'm just like, no, man. I mean, most of my girlfriends are, like, huge comedy fans.
Yeah.
I mean, we're out there. We just don't go to stand... We just... Most girls just didn't go to stand-up shows because they seemed rapey and awful for most of our formative years.
Understandable. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that was huge for me. I mean, I have not missed the opening day of a Jim Carrey movie since Ace Ventura 2.
That's amazing.
That is a streak that continues. That includes the number 23. That includes Popper's Penguins. That includes, what's the, Under the Sea 3D, the Barrier Reef documentary that he... he narrated for all the science centers in the country.
Oh my god.
I went to the science center and was like, it's a Jim Carrey movie, it counts.
Holy shit.
I am a woman of my word, I stick to my guns.
Oh my god. It does not then surprise me that you can stick with stand-up, because again, it takes fucking, like, it takes just, it takes steel guts, whatever you want to call it, to just keep doing stand-up.
My name's Shug McGlumpha, and I live up this close. I'll tell you a story, I promise it's nae boast. During the power cut, I saw a big ghost.
nobody knows that he's there. All together. Oh dear, what can the matter be? I'm scared to go to the lavatory. I've no been since 2 weeks last Saturday. I know who's hiding in there. He had two big red eyes on his head. Was a dead man, big hairy horns, and his neck was all bent, man. My mommy says he sounds just like the Ren Man, but I know who's hiding in there. All together. Oh dear, what can the matter be? I'm feared to go to the lavit. I've no been since 2 weeks last Saturday. I know who's hiding in there. Oh, nice. His mommy sent him to lessons, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, stand-up, it's like, it's, I love it because it's so, it's the most challenging thing you've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And when it goes badly, it's the worst thing. But when it goes well, it is, like, the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's all... It's all you. It's all completely you, and it's all... I mean, once you get used to the idea that the only way that you will get better is by public failure,
mm-hmm.
like, that becomes this weird mantra of just, like, I know once you it's so weird because you have to convince your brain that you're not going to physically die.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, that's what your brain mm-hmm. thinks is going to happen. They're like, oh, no, I'm going to, like, actually just die.
Absolutely,
just,
yeah.
Die in front of all these people, mm-hmm. and then they will just shit on my carcass. And that's what's going to happen. And once you're, like, you've done it enough that you're like, oh, that's not actually going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, all right, well, the only way I find out if a joke needs work is if it doesn't do well.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of becomes this next phase of just, like, embracing public failure.
Sure.
And then it just makes you, or at least me, it's, like, it's made me, like, invincible to a lot of things. Where it's just like, oh, what am I going to do? Not ask somebody out?
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do? Say no?
Right.
200 people hated me
right.
last night.
Right.
I don't give a shit what you think of me. You know, and, like, once you kind of embrace, like, that being just the way you live your life, it, like, just makes you, you can make, it's made me a lot more fearless in a mm-hmm. lot of other ways.
Yeah.
Just to be like, oh, no, I'll say yes to a lot of things now, because it's the worst that's going to happen. I'm not going to physically die, and no one's going to shit on my carcass, so.
Yeah. Is it, do you notice, I don't want to keep you here forever, but do you notice specific areas of your writing that get improved by stand-up, or is it just a general overarching, hey, I'm doing a lot of stand-up, I'm a better writer now? Or do you notice anything specific? Like dialogue, or maybe something else?
Dialogue, definitely. Like, it strengthened my pun muscle a little
uh-huh,
bit.
That's fine.
Which, people got a problem with puns. I love a good
As
pun.
As do I, yep.
Puns are stupid, and mm-hmm. they're fun, and, like, they're comedy math.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's, like, oh, that's the answer.
Yeah.
It's just, like...
Right.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be like, oh, that's what it is. Perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's been fun. Like, it's definitely developed that muscle a lot.
Yeah.
Like, dialogue's definitely improved. I feel like I'm better at writing more naturally with people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm better at heightening. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's gone. Because my stand-up tends to heighten a lot in my jokes. So I've gotten better at that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also better at just, summing something up, like, with, like, a metaphor or something.
Okay, sure.
Like, I've gotten better at being at kind of just... I'm not gonna pull one right now, because why would I when I'm talking about the thing that I've gotten better at? But, like, you know, I've gotten better at being like, oh, this is like this, and these are, like, all the ways that works or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The most vague explanation of what
I know is. Exactly what you're saying.
Okay.
I mean, I don't do stand-up, and I know exactly what you're saying, because whenever I watch stand-up, I'm always like, holy fuck, where did that metaphor come from? They just
yeah.
condense so much for me. I don't have to mm-hmm. listen to them explain it.
Yeah.
That they can say whatever they want now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's cool. Like, it's made me much better at finding connections, and in
mm-hmm.
that way also kind of, like, meaning in a lot of stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
like, if something horrible has happened, as long as I can pull meaning out of it and be like, oh, here are the jokes, this is what this actually means. It's like a weird, like, you can find wisdom with punchlines
mm-hmm.
in bad things that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, comedy's kind of, like, made me better at that.
Yeah.
At being like, oh, right, this awful thing has happened. Not to, like, you know, My mom died like 2.5 months ago. It was really brutal and awful, been a long time coming, but like I'm like developing a lot of good material out of it.
Sure.
Not, and so it's like, it's put some, you know, it's made that like mean more than it would have, I think maybe otherwise.
To be
like, I'm going to have these jokes forever.
Yep.
And they were given to me from this horrible experience.
Yeah.
So I have been able to pull positives from an otherwise awful thing that's happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So like that kind of thing, I think is really, I don't know, that it's made me just like a better writer in that sense. Well, it's also like I did my mom's eulogy and like fucking crushed it. Talking about being a better writer, I literally at the top just wrote riff on Priest before I got into the serious stuff.
That's amazing.
Because I was like, I'm not gonna have a strong opening for this,
right?
So I'm just gonna make fun of the Priest for a minute.
Yeah.
And then we'll just ease into what I really want to talk about.
So good.
And I think comedy is just, if it gives me nothing else, it gave me, you know, I impressed a lot of my dad's rotary buddies with that one. I'm just, to quote my dad, you're a very good public speaker. That's what he says about my comedy.
That's fucking funny. That is really funny. Well, being able to actively deal with something like that, you know, is the mark of a good comedian, if only because some people don't understand it because they do think that that's they will think that joking about anything bad is offensive because it hurts. They don't get it. They think it's disrespectful. But but being able to, again, deal actively with any kind of actual trauma. Rather than the perceived trauma, everyday traumas of what stand-up is about. Like, that's amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and it's just, like, it's a coping mechanism.
Of course.
And it really, like, it empowers you, too, when bad stuff happens. Because you're just like, I get to take control over part of this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the part that I would necessarily want to take complete control of.
Nope.
I mean, I would like my mom to be alive. Yeah. But can't control that. What I can control is a joke about Macy's dresses and how that's what you bury people in and how that's not a campaign that they like actively pursue but maybe they should. Yeah, and like how, like, you know, hundreds of years from now when lizard archaeologists dig us up, they're gonna think Macy's is all that we wore because that's what will be on all of the bodies in the ground.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, and it's like you have like these weird things that come out of nowhere and you're like, huh, that's gonna be fun. We'll see. Like, and then that makes me laugh. And now I've made myself feel better through a horrible experience because I found something funny about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's you know, the best gift that comedy can give you.
Absolutely. And and you can only hope that there's somebody listening who's, again, who's going through the same thing. It's like, oh, fuck, thank you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's important to have that release. Yes. I mean, you know, when it happened, it was, like, really sad, but I didn't, you know, I thought that I would be more upset, but, like, not that I was, like, cracking jokes all over the place.
Right, right.
But, like, your brain gets trained to a point where you're just like, this is a thing that kind of just made me laugh. That's funny. It's fucked up and weird. That's cool. And, like, gallows humor has gotten soldiers through so many things.
Sure.
I'm a big fan of the Hardcore History podcast, and Dan Carlin right now is doing World War One, and it's amazing. The last one that just dropped, I think it's Armageddon Part 3, and he talks about how gallows humor just got most soldiers through World War One because, I mean, I didn't realize how bad the trenches were. Like, they were just parked in.
Oh, yeah.
They were living in their friends' bodies. You know, the floor of the trenches was spongy because they just had light dirt over people's bodies.
Oh, God.
And they were filling sandbags with pieces of their friends. And, like, to be like, oh, there's a little bit of bill over here.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's like, it's a weird mechanism that, like, we, as a people, have just developed because it's the only way to deal with stuff that's out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it like helps you take back some of the power
for sure
from this awful thing that's happened to you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's at the same time acknowledging specifically what just happened.
Yes.
Because there are ways to move past it. And I don't know, but whatever. You've explained it perfectly. That's phenomenal. Actually, you should listen to that podcast.
It's really, really good. I mean, I love everything Dan Carlin does. I mean, I'm like a big history buff too. Like, history is
somehow suspected. I did. Yeah. It was just the way you were talking about certain things and the way you're interested in certain parts of comedy.
Yeah.
I feel like that's more of the domain of stand-ups. I could be wrong. Writers, that is to say.
Yeah.
More the domain of a writer is understanding history.
And it's so cool. I mean, it's like, Abe Lincoln was hilarious.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, that's so cool. I mean, and that guy had the weight of the entire country on his shoulders.
Seriously.
And he still would, like, just be cracking jokes and telling stories. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, that guy aged like crazy if you look at his photos yes. over the course of the Civil War.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he needed that stuff to help him survive. Mm-hmm. Like, people would, in times of pain, like, humor helps you survive through things.
Yeah.
You know? And, I mean, to go back to Billy, it's like, I mean, he, no wonder he's funny. Like, he mm-hmm. went through so much horrible stuff in his childhood that it became like, there has to be, this has to mean something, and it has to mean what I want it to mean. And
right.
I will be the one that controls the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Here are my jokes about it. Fuck you, bad experience
yeah.
that tried to ruin my life.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
We should end there. But I do want to make sure, if you're going to recommend, if nobody's ever heard Billy Connolly,
yeah.
why should they listen to this album?
Listen to the Big Yin, because it if you don't have friends, it'll feel like you got a buddy.
Mm-hmm.
It will feel like you are at the best dinner party ever, because he's just going to tell some great stories, and you just, you will have, like, your step will be lighter because of it.
Yeah.
You'll have a blast.
That's yeah, awesome.
Definitely listen to Billy.
Where can we find you?
I'm on the internet, on Twitter, at Brandazzle, Brandazzle. And then Lady to Lady is my podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And if you live in Los Angeles, look for Picture This. We're at the Tripany House the last Friday in May. And we're also on, add me on Facebook and you'll see all this shit. Brandy Posey, Brandy with an IE, Posey with an EY. And, yeah, say hi. Awesome. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a ton of fun. Everybody, thank you for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.